Mr. Woolard, before we talk about your military experiences, could you tell us about your background?
Yes. I was born in Cowden, Illinois, on June 6, 1924. I was born into a family that basically followed agriculture. My grandfather on my mother's side was a farmer. On my father's side, farming had occupied the family for some time, but also they followed carpentry as a skill and as a means of employment. My father and in growing up, I was privileged to have very loving parents, people who spent a lot of time with us, both my brother and I. I have one brother who is 2 years younger. We spent a lot of time with my grandparents during the summer, enjoyed it very much, and developed a keen interest in the lives of my grandparents and the associated people who lived around the general area of Shelby County. My brother and I very early developed an interest in reading, and this was prompted, I think, by my mother, who had graduated from a high school, which was a bit unusual at the time. She graduated when she was 16 and was offered a scholarship to what at the time was Illinois State Normal University. But being 16 years of age, her parents felt that I was a bit young to leave home. And my father, on the other hand, had been put to work at the age, well, he finished eighth grade and then was put to work with neighboring farmers to help with the livelihood of the total family. He was also quite interested in education, and had he had the privilege of going to school longer, it would have augured well for him. We lived in Hillsboro, Illinois, for the first 6 years of my life. In Hillsboro, I started to elementary school, and at that time, at the age of six, the Great Depression was just beginning. My father had worked at the glass company in Hillsboro. It closed at the beginning of the Depression. At the close of the glass company, my father was out of work for well over a year. He traveled all over the state trying to get something to do, shucked corn in northern Illinois, sold newspapers, did what he could to keep the family together. I well remember the effect of the those years on both my family and the family of some of my cousins. And I'll go into that in a moment. But at the close of the glass company and being out of work, my father looked to the glass company in Alton, Illinois, one that was still functioning. It was the world's largest glass company, and they had just installed new equipment, equipment that the factory in Hillsboro had. And my father knew that they would need operators for this new equipment. They found out about my father. They called him, and he had a job for the rest of the Depression, in fact, for the rest of his life. My father was an insistent man. He wanted more than anything else that his sons get an education, a college education. And he worked diligently to see that happen. It finally did happen after at the end of World War II. I had developed in high school an interest in history, and I wanted to be a teacher. This was prompted pretty largely by a high school teacher that I had, a man by the name of Harlow. Very good teacher, and took an interest in me. And following the war, I went to college and then eventually to the university, and getting a master's degree from Washington University in St. Louis, a degree in education and educational administration, and a degree also Master of Arts in History. So education has been a large part of my life, my brother's life as well. He eventually wound up graduating from Harvard. he followed a military career for his entire life, becoming a commander of the Green Beret operation in Southeast Asia during the Vietnam War. I had no interest in being in the military, but I did have an interest in teaching. And after the war, I got my first job in McLean County as a junior high school teacher, and was very privileged to serve under a superintendent who I admired greatly. It was a small district, about 100 square miles, and he showed me the paces of what it means to be a principal, a teacher, a principal, and eventually a superintendent. Mm-hmm. And I've been all three. Then I went on to teach at Bradley University for about 6 years. coming back now, we, at the beginning of World War II, I can well remember when it started for me. I was working in a theater. I was in high school, and there flashed on the movie screen something I'd never seen there before. The operator had stopped the projectors, and it inserted a slide which had said, "We are at war with Japan." Mm. It was on a Sunday afternoon, and that piqued my interest and curiosity. I graduated from high school in 1943, January of 1943, a mid-year graduation. I knew that I would be drafted. I also decided that I would try to take a month or a month and a half and work for somebody to establish a relationship with some industry, for example, the glass factory, that you never know what turn the economy is going to take. And if you have a relationship with an industry, you might get a job after mm-hmm. the war. Mm-hmm. At least, and this is what my father suggested to me. But in April of 1943, I was drafted, and I was sent to Scott Air Force Base in East St. Louis, or near East St. Louis. And there I was given a battery of tests of all kinds. And I was a bit surprised at this. I thought that probably you're just taken in and slapped into a unit and away mm-hmm. you go. But it was a rather extensive battery of tests, at the conclusion of which I was called in to a counselor's office, and he asked me about some of my interests. And he said, well, I'll let you go two ways. He said, we can put you into some kind of office work in the Army, or you can go into infantry intelligence. Now, I didn't know what infantry intelligence was. I had an idea what infantry was, but intelligence was an alien field to me. Had I known what it would eventually entail, I might have changed my mind. But I said I'll take intelligence, because I didn't want to just stay in an office during this war. Mm-hmm. So I was put into training in infantry intelligence, sent to Fort McClellan, Alabama, as for basic training, 16 weeks. It was an interesting 16 weeks. We were trained extensively, although I must say, not given very adequate training in the field of intelligence, but an awful lot in infantry. We lived in barracks, wooden barracks, 25, 30 men in a barracks. It was hot, and sometimes it was so hot and humid that tempers would be a bit short. But I had a great deal of admiration for some of the trainers, the permanent cadre at Fort McClellan. I recall one of them very well. He was our platoon leader, and he was a tough guy. His name was Huff, and he had five brothers who were also in the cadre in Fort McClellan. And he told us that if any of us got out of line and he couldn't put us in line, he had five brothers who would help him. But he was an extremely fair man. And if you got chewed out, you deserved it. And he chewed me out a couple of times, and I deserved it. But a very good man for training. The people in the intelligence group were very interesting. A lot of college fellows and bright young men. At the same time, in a barracks across the street, there were men who were studying coding. That there's a lot of code work in the Army, and it takes a very keen, smart person to be in that particular section. You have machines that help you code messages, but there's also other work involved. But I recall also that in my particular platoon, there was a tackle from the University of Mississippi, a tackle from the University of Louisiana. There was a fellow who played professional football with the old Chicago Cardinals. He was a guard. I met him after the war under very unusual circumstances. And they're all good people. At the conclusion of our basic training, they went various directions. We all went different ways. But occasionally I would hear of one or two of them. Most of them, unfortunately, did not make it through the war. We had excellent food. I had always interested in the Southern boys and what they called some of the dishes that we had. If we drank milk, it was always sweet milk. You had some sweet milk, and that was. And we also had coffee milk. It's the first time I'd ever had that. First time I ever had honeydew melon. And I found out very quickly that army cooks are not to be messed with. They are the king of the kitchen. And if you go in, you better have a good reason to be there. They were, I had many occasions to have run-ins with an army cook. And there was always a different kind of a thrill. 16 weeks was all they were allowed for basic training. That's all you would get. There was no further training for the intelligence section. At the end of that period, we could elect, if we wished to go into the paratroops. And I don't like to climb ladders even, so I didn't go that direction.
So that was the end of training? There was no advanced training after that?
That was it.
That was it. Do you feel that that training was adequate for preparing you for what you met when you were in battle?
Not really. No. And the battlefield experience, I found, was a bit different than what they were telling us at Fort McClellan. Mm-hmm. For example, at Fort McClellan, they taught us map reading using aerial photographs. And we had aerial photograph training and looking at those photographs through a little magnifier. We never had a photograph all during war. My squad never had a photograph all through the war. Mm-hmm. Never had occasion. And there were other things, other experiences like that. We, at the end of the 16-week period, we got 1 week at home. Mm-hmm. And that was pure joy. I got all the cake I could eat. We then went, I had to report to the East Coast, and we went to New Jersey, and then to a loading dock on the coast, where we got on what were called, well, there were troop ships. They were sometimes called the Victory Ship. Mm-hmm. They had been mass-produced during the early part of the war.
At what point did you know where you were going, or did you not know?
We didn't know mm-hmm. when we got on the boat. Mm-hmm. And but it soon became apparent from the sailors on the boat that they knew pretty well where we were going. And these, when I say sailors, there were more merchant mariners on there than mm-hmm. U.S. Army or U.S. sailors. And they weren't at all hesitant to tell you where they think you're going. Mm-hmm. There were at least 1,000 men on the ship that we were on. We were bunked in a hold deep in the bowels of the boat. And the sleeping arrangements, we were cramped together. There were bunk after bunk, five bunks high, and an aisle about that wide between the bunks. I slept in my bunk one night. It took 12 days to get across the Atlantic. I slept there one night and decided I didn't want any more of that. So I took my blanket and went up and slept in an aisleway in the middle of the ship, just on a piece of iron. And that's where I spent the nights. And most of the men got ill, seasick, terrible mess. the urinals all full. The boat would rock, and it was stormy, mm-hmm. and the urinals would splash out, and it was just terrible to try to live in. I became ill with the rest, and about the time I was getting better, I went and got some food in the chow line and took it to the edge, up on the deck, and there was an upper deck above me. And I was just ready to eat when the fellow above me, he lost all of his cookies and right in my mess kit. And I went without food for another few days. It was, there was nothing to do. There was no planned entertainment. What I found some fellows were doing, they had a quarter, or usually a quarter, and they'd take a spoon and begin hammering away on this quarter and then making a ring or making a piece of jewelry out of it. It was just something to do, mm-hmm. something to do. The course and direction of the boats changed about every half hour. We were escorted. Now, there were several of these boats in our convoy. About every half hour, the direction would change because the destroyers, the destroyers were really in command. And they would give a signal, and all the boats would turn a different direction. We were trying to avoid attack by submarine. Mm-hmm. Then half an hour would go another direction. And that's the reason it took so long to get across. We landed in Casablanca, Morocco, but simply to load on trucks, and went to a freight station, or a railroad station. The railroad station, I quickly noted, were narrow gauge railroads. Now, the meaning by that the rails are closer together than on mm-hmm. American railroads. The rail cars, box cars, were about half the size of the American box car. We were loaded into those box cars, about 18 men to a car. And we headed out, and we felt by this time that we all knew that we were going to go to Oran, Africa. It was the only logical point mm-hmm. that we could go to. And it was a beautiful country. The Atlas Mountains of northeastern or northwestern Africa are gorgeous. And the valleys were full of citrus fruits, citrus orchards. We took about almost a week to get to Oran. on the way, we ate from canned rations. That's all we had. And I had some coffee that we could make. We had each one of the box cars had a little makeshift stove that we could heat things on. So we got to Oran, or the outskirts of Oran. We took about 4 or 5 days to do some forced marches to. We'd been on a boat and we'd been on this train and we needed mm-hmm. to loosen up and get toughened up again. So we went on forced marches, which were rather deadly. They were, I recall, over half the men would fall out on those marches. And I never fell out, but I felt like doing it sometimes. Mm-hmm. We did it at this point. We were loaded on small boats, crossed the Mediterranean, landing at Naples, Italy, passing the Isle of Capri as we went into the harbor. Now, excuse me. I'm going to pause here for a moment and just give you a thumbnail sketch of those geographic areas in which I served. Of course, Africa. And by the way, while I was in North Africa, just for those 4 or 5 days, I happened to see an auction at which a woman was sold for, I don't know how many goats or a camel or something. Mm. That sort of thing was still going on. all right, back to the geography. I was in North Africa, Italy. From Italy, went to France. From France, into the Alsace area between Germany and France. Went into Germany. At the end of the war, I was deep into Austria. That's where I was when the war ended. now, in Naples, we were given some clean equipment, clean clothes. We were given shots of various, prevent various diseases. We had a little entertainment while we were there. I recall that Joe Louis, the boxer, heavyweight champ, came in and gave a boxing exhibition one night. And it was quite a thrill to see him. He was quite a man. In a few days, we were told that we would be going up and joining our division. A division, as you may know, is about 16,000 strong men. A division has 3 regiments. Each regiment, for example, the regiments that I were in the 36th Infantry Division. I belonged to the 142nd Regiment. There was the 141st, 142nd, 143rd. Each regiment has a series of battalions, and 3 battalions. Each battalion has 4 companies. Each company has about 4 platoons of 30 to 40 men each. Mm-hmm. And that then there are other units that are attached now and then. We occasionally would have an attachment from an artillery unit or a medical unit. Depending on the circumstances, the need for support, the need for medical attention, etc. And the Army today still has divisions, but the divisions are structured somewhat differently. There's been a lot of changes, and much of it is very debatable in the past couple, 3 years. Mm-hmm. But in Naples, I was told I would be assigned to the 36th Infantry Division. I knew that the 36th Infantry Division had been on the initial landing in Italy. Winston Churchill had insisted to Eisenhower that we attack what Winston Churchill called the soft underbelly of Europe. And it turned out not to be
He's going to change the tape.
All right.
You were talking about Winston Churchill.
Yes, he was insistent that there be some action in southern Europe. And the 36th Infantry Division was elected, so to speak, to be the spearhead division to land in Italy. And on September 9th, 1943, the 36th landed on the beach at Salerno Bay. They almost got pushed off the beach. It was just to back up a moment. The German commanders were very keen. I think the best commander of all the generals in Italy was the German commander, Kesselring. He was very, very able. Now, we had better commanders than he eventually, but in Italy, we suffered occasionally from lack of leadership. I'm not saying that as from my own standpoint, but what I read from military historians and others. Well, September 9th, the landing took place. The Germans had very superior tank equipment, and they almost pushed us off the beach. I was, of course, not with the unit yet, and I'll get to that, but from those men who were there, the only thing that saved us was they took our, what we called our 105-millimeter howitzers. It's a good big round shell. It's never meant for direct fire. It's meant to lob shells over. The Germans were so close from here to that wall over there that they had to use their 105-millimeter howitzers to blow up the German tanks. And they would blow the tanks out of the water, but that was the only thing that saved the 36th Infantry Division. And once they had that settled, they began pushing on north. And I'll come to where I joined the division here shortly. In Naples, again, it was raining most of the time. It was a miserable place to be. We were in what was called Mussolini's sports arena. And it was a huge arena, big flat area in the middle where we had tents. It, as I said, was raining a good part of the time. Along with the other people in the tent I was in, we had a little free time and we walked around Naples. Naples isn't the most attractive city in the world, and some very large slum areas to the city, although you get to a certain section on the north end where some of the richer people live. There is some very beautiful homes and buildings. We, the 36th Division went from Salerno up the Italian peninsula, and they had to fight their way all the way up, and eventually came to a town by the name of San Pietro. San Pietro is a town of maybe 10,000 people, Italians. And our I still was not with the unit as yet. But the division had the job of running over that town and chasing the Germans out. And they eventually did, but with a staggering loss of men. And by the way, this eventually became the subject of perhaps the best war picture to come out of World War II. It's called San Pietro. And the book I have provided you has a few pictures of San Pietro in it. I recall talking, after I joined the unit, I recall talking to a squad leader who had been observing the town as the town was attacked. He was observing it through glasses, field glasses. And he was watching two men. One was a German soldier. One was an American soldier. And one was coming down one street, the other street. They saw one another at the same time. They each pulled the trigger about the same time. They both were killed. It's kind of a strange coincidence. well, I joined the 36th Division in December of 1943, about December 23rd. The division had still been in combat every day. Now they were pulled off, or a few at a time were pulled off to rest for 2 days and to get replacements, because they were desperately in need of replacements. It was raining all day on the 23rd of December. It was about dusk when I arrived at the division by jeep. I met the first sergeant of the company. He's a man he's a man about 39, 40. And I grew to respect him greatly. And he lived through the war. I was glad glad that he did. He was the guy that held the company together. You know, they can say all they want about the officers, the captains, and the majors, and so on. But you got to have a good first sergeant.
What was it that he did that kept everyone together?
Extreme fairness. If you had to go on patrol, which is a dirty job, the next patrol that went out, you didn't have to go. You know, he divided the work. He assigned responsibilities. If you had a sector that you were going to defend, he made sure that you had the equipment and the manpower to do it. He was just a very even-tempered man, very even-tempered. But when he spoke, you know, you better listen. So I really respected him. Now, he was a member. I should tell you this. The 36th Division was a Texas division. It was a Texas National Guard. And the old-timers in it were Texans, cowboys. Some of them were half Indian. Had a fellow named Lightfoot who was mostly Indian. But the first sergeant was a Texan. Now, it didn't make any difference. He didn't favor the Texans over the other guys. Well, December 23rd, I joined the division. He took me around, introduced me to the intelligence squad. I was eager to see what these fellows looked like. And they were dug in at the base of a little hill. And there were only about 8 of them left, and out of a squad of 12. So they introduced me, and I was left to my own devices after that. What am I going to do? Am I going to dig a hole, or what am I to do? I got no direction there at that particular point. But there was another young fellow who joined the unit. His name was Dean Steele, and he was going to join the radio section. He was a radio operator. And so he was at loose ends. We put our shelter halves together, formed a tent, plopped down in a muddy field, and slept all night. Got up the next morning to the sound of one of the Texans singing, "Oh, what a beautiful morning," and it was still raining. We woke up on the 24th. We moved a mile closer to the front. We bivouacked, or we put up a little tent and dug a hole. I was still with Dean Steele. We were very close to this artillery unit, and the artillery men didn't stop for Christmas. They just kept firing and firing, and it was what we call outgoing ammo. So on the 25th, we went up on the line, the front line. We went up and relieved elements of the 3rd Infantry Division, which was a very good division. We, as we went up, Sergeant Smith, who was the intelligence squad sergeant, took me aside and he said, "You're going to be with me." And he took me under his wing. We got to the top of this hill, overlooking a huge valley, and he said, "You dig in with me. I'll show you how to dig a good foxhole." Sergeant Smith probably saved my life, because he taught me, you know, the sound of different weaponry. German machine pistol has a certain sound. A German machine gun has a different sound. An 88-millimeter German anti-tank shell has a very distinctive sound. He taught me all those things. Mm-hmm. And they were critical to staying alive. Mm-hmm. I got down to basics. If you're stuck in your foxhole and you can't get out because of enemy fire, how do you use the toilet? What do you do with the waste? Can you stay in there and still live? It was just basic kinds of information. Well, Smith was a very good soldier. But I'll tell you, now that at a certain point, as we moved on during the war, he became extremely nervous, and the pressure got to him, and he just kind of went to pieces. So he had to go back, and never really saw him again. We either went home or got some job in quartermaster or something. Mm-hmm. But he was a very good man. The work at that time, in some days, was humdrum. S2, our intelligence squad, we did observation work. We had field glasses. This is just one aspect of the work. We kept our field glasses trained on across the valley, and we knew the Germans were entrenched on a hillside on beyond. We watched very carefully. especially at night. Now, one of the skills that you learn is how to determine where an enemy piece of equipment is located, an artillery piece. There's a method called triangulation. And I'm here on this outpost, and over here in another battalion is this S2 guy who's also watching. And at night, you watch for gun flashes or artillery flashes out of the muzzle of a German gun. You take what's called an azimuth from the position of this man over here. He takes an angular shot with his compass, and he's at a certain angle mm-hmm. from this man. I do the same thing. And we also compute from the time of the flash till the artillery piece lands where you are, hopefully not right at you, but at a point, and you know that it took 2 seconds or 3 seconds, and you know that the muzzle velocity of an 88-millimeter gun is 2,700 feet per second. And you put all those factors together, and even though that artillery piece may be behind a small mountain over there, you know pretty well where he's located. Mm-hmm. And you can begin to throw your own artillery there. That's one aspect of our work. And however, there were other factors, or other ways of getting intelligence. We also did patrol work. This is the most dangerous of the work. We went out on patrols at night with the intent of capturing enemy soldiers. If we didn't capture them, we at least got a hold of them. And sometimes we'd, off of a dead soldier, we'd get a piece of their uniform that showed their division stripe or mm-hmm. their division symbol. If we were able to get a prisoner or two, we would bring them back. My squad, we had two men who spoke German, one man who spoke French, one man who spoke Italian. And between them, we could get some conversation going with this German soldier. And that was, we would talk with him, get as much as we could, and then send them on back to people who had more time to mm-hmm. do the talking. But it's a part of the intelligence picture. If the prisoner would talk and say how long his unit had been online, we knew that it was fresh, it was probably pretty tough. If they'd been online for 3 weeks or 4 weeks, they might be tired, and mm-hmm. all those things. You build a picture of mm-hmm. who's out there ahead of you. So that was another aspect of the work, and one of the very important ones. There were perhaps an even more deadly thing, and we didn't have to do it often because our first sergeant he was rather adamant about making people share the work. Sometimes we'd have to go on a point. Now, a point means that you're ready for an attack. You're going to attack a hill or a city. You send out your point squad. Those are the first men to go. Now, the reason for using the intelligence squad occasionally for that was you drew the first fire. When you drew the first fire, you knew the position of some of the German machine guns, or perhaps you got around from an anti-tank weapon, the 88 millimeter. And you quickly sized up what was out there and reported back, and you could do that with radio. You reported back as what you saw and what you think you're faced with. So then the company commander or the platoon sergeant could make some adjustments so he knew just what his next step should be. But it was pretty dangerous work. I was really on a point only two or three times. And that was kind of the intelligence operation. We did regular infantry work when it was necessary, and often was. In other words, when we were being attacked, you became a rifleman. You became a BAR, Browning Automatic Rifleman, whatever weapon you had, and you expected to defend yourself. Mm-hmm. Well, again, we had joined the division, and the 36th Division was at this point just below the town of Cassino, Italy. Most military historians say that the worst fighting in World War II was at Cassino. Mm-hmm. Bar none, even mm-hmm. the D-Day was not as rough as the day-after-day grinding that you took at Cassino. Cassino was located at the base of a large mountain. And it's a city today of probably 30 to 40,000 people. At that time, it was probably a little bit smaller, but most of the people were gone. Just above the town, this mountain, and on the top of it was an abbey built in 1400 called Monte Cassino Abbey. Very famous abbey built by Benedictine monks. And the feeling was that the Germans were using this abbey as an observation post. And the debate raged as to whether they were or they weren't, and if they were, what should we do about it? Well, let me step back just a few days and give you some of the idea about the weather that we were in, we were having. It was miserable at the, a miserable valley that, and mountains that we were in. We the mud was ankle deep in the valleys. As you went up the mountains, sometimes it was raining, and as you got near the top, the snow. And we often were in snowy areas. Frostbite was a real factor. I remember seeing men crawl down the side of the mountain to an aid station because their feet were so numb that they couldn't stand on them. They couldn't mm-hmm. feel their feet. Mm-hmm. And you had to, at night, if you could, take your shoes off and rub your toes and keep them, keep some circulation. And I know I got frostbite, but I didn't have to go back for it, but it bothered me for a long time. On one occasion, at the Cassino front, the Germans pushed through a group of Italians. Now, the Germans didn't want to take care of them. They said, let the Americans take care of them. They pushed them through the lines, and they happened to come through my platoon and company area. And these were men and women and children. Mm-hmm. And I saw two men without shoes. And it was snowing. We didn't have much we could give them, mm-hmm. except to direct them on down to the base of the mountain. But the civilians suffered, and there's no question about it. The Italian people had very little stomach for that war. Mm-hmm. Mussolini was, they had little respect for him after the war started. We used the Italian soldiers as men to bring the burros up the side of the mountain with our ammunition and with our food. And these burros were brought in from Arkansas. And they were very sturdy pack animals. The Italian, thinking that these burros were from the USA, they would get mad at them and try to curse them in English, thinking that the burros could understand that a bit better. But we were given our food and daily rations by a steady supply of food that came up by burros most of the way. It was coming up the mountains on the casino front, the mountains that we occupied. It was a four-hour journey up and a four-hour journey mm-hmm. down. And the burros could only go partway. We would meet the burros and load the ammunition into our packs and carry mm-hmm. them on the rest of the way. Back to Monte Cassino. Monte Cassino.
Okay, we're going to stop again. Mm-hmm. Ralph Woolard is the veteran of World War II who is talking about his experiences, and he is going to continue talking about Monte Cassino.
Monte Cassino Abbey, again, was a very highly debated matter. Most of the men in my company who were Catholic felt that we should try to destroy that abbey. They said, men first and structures later. However, and a lot of political pressure from the Vatican, for example, that wanted it saved. And that went back and forth, and finally General Eisenhower made the decision as to what should happen. But before I get to that, I relate one event that took place on the casino front that cost us our battalion commander. It was early on in my experience with the 36th, but it had direct relationship to the 36th, or to the casino, because of the positions that the Germans had. The Germans always were able to fall back into prepared positions. They had slave labor that built great fortifications and holds for their men to get down in, and with well-protected rooftops over these holes. Well, I hadn't been in the division more than 10, 12 days. It was early in January. And we received notice that we were to do some adjustment in our lines, the disposition of these units. And we were to move a couple of miles over and replace a unit that we thought was an American unit. The whole battalion was to move. So we got over to the area that we felt we were to occupy and found out that a French unit had occupied it 2 days before. That was, they had just been placed there. And couldn't understand why they were to be moved. They hadn't received any notices. Well, obviously it was a mistake someplace. And we referred earlier to the polyglot of different peoples who were in the Italian campaign. Japanese Americans, for example, the best fighting unit in the whole war, the most highly decorated. They were on the front there. Not particularly at this particular thing I'm talking about now, but there they were. The New Zealanders, the British, the Free French, elements of the French Foreign Legion, New Zealanders, the Polish, Sikhs from North Africa, mm-hmm. Sikhs from India, and goons from North Africa. They were Arabs, really, who loved to go out on patrol and come back with, as they used to say, with German ears. They loved their knives. Well, what to do? We didn't know what to do. Battalion commander signaled out, or said, Lieutenant Hashmeyer, you get a couple of your fellows from intelligence squad, and we're going to go down and talk to somebody in the French unit if we can find him. So I was one of the persons chosen to go down. Now, Lieutenant Hashmeyer, you'll hear of him later also, was a fellow from near Macomb, Illinois. He was about 28, 29, college graduate. He was our S2 or intelligence unit leader. Of course, we liked him very much. He was an old farm boy. But we took off with the battalion commander. We found a French officer, a platoon lieutenant, who could speak passable English. And he said, well, we've just, you know, just got here. I have no reason to want to move. We don't have orders to move. And our battalion commander asked, well, where is your commander? He said, well, I think it might be down the road a kilometer or two. There's a little hamlet down there. Now, we were in almost total darkness. It was very dark, and I'm happy for it. So we went down the road. Our troops had been instructed to get into a large grove of olive trees, and this would hide them from the Germans. And they simply, troops just took a rest while all this was going on. And the commander and all of us went down to this hamlet. We searched through, didn't find a soul. We stepped out of the back door of the last house we were in and walked a few feet and noticed barbed wire, rolls of it on, went on as far as we could see, and a little sign on it that we knew the word, German word for minefield. And this was a minefield of the Germans, and that they had erected, and we were on the wrong side of it. And we knew that we shouldn't be there. We didn't have the manpower to be there at that point. Mm-hmm. So we tried to beat a hasty retreat. We went back through the houses. We stepped out of the house, gone maybe 25 or 30 feet, when the first shell from an 88-millimeter anti-tank gun hit the road in front of us. And then a few seconds later, the second one. The battalion commander says, I'm hit. And we grabbed him. We ran back to the house with him. That was closest shelter we could find. Ran back to the house. We got there. He was still talking. We could tell that he had a very serious wound. And he said, my bowels have to move. Can you help me? Well, we took his pistol belt. He wore a pistol. And we took the pistol belt and got his pants down, got him into a squatting position. His pants and underwear were full of blood. As we got him into a position, he fell back and died. Mm-hmm. And there was nothing more that we could do for him. We, Lieutenant Hashmeyer, radioed up to battalion and asked for a stretcher and two stretcher bearers. And despite the danger of the situation, well, they came down and got the commander. And there was no more shelling. Fortunately, we went back up to the battalion. By this time, a new battalion commander, the second in charge, had assumed the role. We still didn't have any word from the regiment as or the division as to what had gone wrong and where we were, what was going to become of us. And so the new battalion commander said, take me back to the French lieutenant. I want to talk to him. We took him back there. The lieutenant, French lieutenant said, I have a patrol out. I'm worried about them. They're overdue. Mm-hmm. And about that time, we heard an explosion. Now, we knew enough that, well, Sergeant Smith had told me what to listen for, and I knew that it was either a hand grenade or a landmine, because there was no incoming sound. Mm-hmm. And indeed it was a landmine, and the French patrol had encountered it, and one of their members was hurt. And they had fallen to the ground and just kind of froze. They were afraid to take steps. But then the Germans started throwing mortar shells in on that sound that they had heard there. And the French patrol had nothing they could do but get up and run toward to get to their own lines. Callously leaving the wounded man in the minefield and in the barbed wire. Well, fortunately, two very brave French medics went in and got him. And I saw him when he came out. His foot was blown off a few inches above the ankle and completely off. So we... there wasn't much use talking anymore with the French lieutenant. He had his own problems. So we went back up to our battalion headquarters up there among the trees. By this time, we had word from the regiment that there had been a mistake, and we were to remain in position in that grove overnight, and then we were told to where to move out to. We bedded down about 6 o'clock the next morning. We were rolling up our blankets, getting ready to depart, when we heard a loud noise, like a rumbling, and looking down onto this road that led down to the hamlet. Well, coming from a friendly direction was three huge wooden wagons, and they were laden with ammunition and with food for the French forces. Each wagon was pulled by four horses. And they were on this road, way across the valley. Directly ahead of them were Germans who were looking at this. And within just a minute, the artillery began to rain on these horses and the men driving them. It was a horrendous, horrible scene. Nothing escaped. The men were killed. The horses that were not killed immediately were walking around, slipping and sliding on their own entrails. And our first sergeant, whom I've told you about, he was probably the closest man to those wagons. And he always carried a Thompson submachine gun. And he went down to the edge of the grove of olive trees, and using that gun, he dispatched the horses that weren't already dead. Now that only the French could get involved. It was so stupid of them. I just have to say that. It was so apparent that if anyone was there, they could know to stay off that road in the daytime. And nighttime, you have to take some chances. But, well, we, under a new commander, he led us out, avoiding stepping out on the road. We kept in an olive grove all the way out and behind a hill where we couldn't be seen, and we moved to a different position. Those were 2 days in January that I mm-hmm. won't forget. And now back to Monte Cassino Abbey.
Could you do me a favor and set down that green folder for me, if you could?
Take your phone.
Oh, I'm sorry. Monte Cassino Abbey is still on my mind here. And we had reduced the city of Cassino to nothing but rubble. We had just pulverized it. But indeed, it had only made the city stronger, the German troops that were there. There were a few of them killed, yes. But big concrete slabs were blown up, and there were the soldiers could get under those slabs and be protected from small arms fire. So all these different troops tried getting into Cassino. You know, they would get maybe to the outskirts, and then Germans would throw them back. The German troops in Italy were very, very good troops. We underestimated what they were. And they were, as I said, led by Marshal Kesselring, who was probably one of the most able of the commanders. Then the decision was made to let the Americans try to get into Cassino. And this involved a very complicated maneuver of crossing the Rapido River that ran through the valley. And it made all kinds of S turns, and in preparation for that, we were sent some rubber boats that you could put into the water, and some paddles to get across the river. And we were down at way to the east of, or west of Casino, and we hoped that getting across the river there, we could come in from the west, and while some other troops were attacking from the other side. So this was a wild idea by the general who was in charge of the Fifth Army. And he's become rather infamous among Texans, who blame him for a good many things. But he wasn't the most able man. But at any rate, the 143rd Infantry or Regiment was given the job of crossing, first of all. We would cross at midnight. The 143rd would cross, then the 141st. Well, the 143rd would establish a position. Then the next regiment would come through and push on beyond that. And then our division would come through last, or our regiment would come through last. It never got to our regiment. The terrific gunfire from Germans. They leveled every piece of artillery they had on the Rapido River area. The fragmentation cut the rubber boats, just sliced it. They would fill with water and sink. And there they were with a paddle and no boat. Mm. But sometimes you could just wade across the river. The fighting went on 2 days. They never established a large enough foothold for my regiment to come in and mm-hmm. and finish the work. So at the end of 2 days of fighting, the Germans asked for a truce. And I think it was the only truce in World War II to pick up the dead and the wounded. We granted that because we wanted to do the same. The truce was to last about 4 hours. The Germans asked for an extension on the time. Our leader said, no, he can't have, but they did give him another half hour or something like mm-hmm. that. And I was not there to do that. To help with that, they brought in a lot of medics to do it. But the German soldiers and American soldiers exchanged cigarettes and that sort of thing. Rather surreal event, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was, I believe, the only truce in World War II. Well, we lost about 1,800 men in that engagement, killed and wounded. It was a terrific battle. All right, the sentiment grew to do away with the Monte Cassino Abbey. Now, my division, the 36th, was pulled off the line before the Abbey was destroyed. Mm-hmm. We were pulled off to go to Anzio. Now, I've seen pictures of the destroying of the Abbey, and of course, it took sent in our big bombers, the B-25s and so on, and they just blew it off the mountain mm-hmm. in a few hours. I've been a casino since then. It's been beautifully restored. But by most estimates, and most people believe now, that the Germans never used it as an observation post.
Mm.
No one ever saw a German soldier run out of the place when it was bombed. So it was probably a mistake. Yet psychologically, it was a big boost. It was a big boost to our troops. They said, hooray, now we can go and get Cassino. Mm-hmm. Well, it wasn't that easy. I said we were pulled off the line to go to Anzio. Now, the military brass knew that we were really bogged down at Cassino. Well, you know, we can't get out of here. We can't advance toward Rome and on up this boot that constitutes Italy. The idea was to have an invasion north of the German lines. The German line ran all the way across Italy. So here's the German boot. We were here at Anzio, here at Cassino, and we were down here. We thought if we can get a flotilla of boats and invade north of the German line, we could cut off the Germans and cut off their supply routes, and it wouldn't be long before we would have them. And two divisions, the 45th Infantry Division, which is an Oklahoma division, and I believe the 3rd Division, were assigned to go in at Anzio. Anzio was a little town along the Italian coast on the east west side. We thought that it would be a cakewalk, and we could trap the Germans. And we got into Anzio, the city, fairly easily. But the Germans sensed what we were doing, and they put a ring of steel, so to speak, of German divisions around that city of Anzio. Now, not the city itself, but on the mountains behind the city of Anzio. And as we moved in, we met this, what we called a ring of steel. We just found that they were tougher than we had anticipated. And we just got bogged down. And that was the reason for pulling the 36th Infantry Division off the Cassino line, putting them on boats, and going into Anzio, and have them lead in a breakthrough, a breakout, in this ring of steel.
Mm.
So we got there, and we took positions. Pause here for just a moment. I noticed one thing as I walked into the city of Anzio and the outskirts. We had established a hospital there for the wounded. And to establish a hospital, engineers had dug huge holes so that about 4 feet deep, and it'd maybe be 80 or 90 feet across and 80 or 90 feet long.
Mm-hmm.
And when you walked around this, and this only your head showed above the embankments. And there were nurses, women, who were working in there. And I have to give credit to the Army nurses. They did a terrific job under sometimes very dangerous conditions. That hospital, hospital was under, well within artillery range. And they carried on, and they carried on very, very well. So okay. I pay tribute to them.
Oh, we're going to change tapes. Okay. We are talking with Ralph Wagner Woolard, and we are now going to be talking about his experiences in Anzio during World War II.
I was speaking of the nurses and the very remarkable job they did under very difficult circumstances. And I have nothing but praise for them. They were skilled, and they were also courageous. Right, our job as 36th Infantry was to break through in early May the this ring of steel around the town of Anzio, and then another town called Velletri. Then my regiment did a very unusual thing. The 143rd and 141st regiments were assigned to attack the mountains that the Germans were on all around us. And the 142nd, my regiment, one night found a gap in the German line, meaning there were no soldiers there for some reason. And in the middle of the night, we infiltrated through that line an entire regiment of people. And up even higher on the mountains than the Germans. Mm. We were well arranged. We spread ourselves out, knowing where the spearhead was to be, and waited for the attack to come. And we would, as we hoped the Germans would be chased up the hill to where we were, mm-hmm. we would be waiting for them. Well, my squad, as it usually was all alone for some reason. It wasn't unusual for the intelligence squad to be on its own, because we had a different work most of the time than other squads had. Mm-hmm. So Lieutenant Hashmeyer from Macomb, Illinois, and there were seven or eight of us who were still active. And we were trying to make some coffee. And the attack had started. We knew that probably it would be a little while before the Germans came up the hill. And but all of a sudden, we heard somebody moving in the bushes and the trees on down the hill. And we thought, well, it's not an American troop or organization of any kind. It has to be German. So Lieutenant Hashmeyer took charge, and he said, spread yourselves out. We're going down to meet them. And Hashmeyer was on my immediate right, about 15 feet. And the rest of the squad was out to the left. And we started marching down to the, marching or moving down to the trees. And there was a crack of a pistol. I knew it wasn't a rifle, it was just pistol crack. And Hashmeyer was hit. Mm-hmm. Knocked him down. And then the fellow, the German who had fired the pistol, jumped up immediately, threw his pistol down and said, "Comrade." There is a problem sometimes. I think American troops conduct themselves and deport themselves better than most troops in the world. They have more compassion. And, you know, you have problems that way every once in a while. Mm-hmm. But by and large, they're pretty good about handling prisoners. But in an instance like that, the emotions are extremely, you know, they're mm-hmm. rock high. And the anger is there as well. Hashmar was well liked. And you know, you run into those instances like that occasionally, and what happens? Sometimes it ends one way, and sometimes it ends another. Mm-hmm. But Hashmar, we had to get a stretcher for him, and took him on back. Well, we waited for a little while till some of the units came up the hill, unfortunately, some American units where we were, and took charge of Hashmar. Hashmar died on his way to the first aid station, however. That was really a sad day for our group. The in fact, I'm going to come back to one other instance. I meant to tell about it. This, if you don't mind my backing up a moment.
Not at all.
This was at Casino. We were at the top of a mountain in a little hamlet, 10 or 12 houses. It was on a Sunday, and along comes a minister. I'd seen him before a couple of times. He was a guy without a lot of education. He was a Baptist, and about 45 years of age. And he would sometimes hold a service. But here he was up at the top of this mountain, and we were being shelled furiously. And he went from house to house, and he says, "Boys, I'm going to have a service. It's going to be across the street in that house." And he said, "If you want to come, come ahead." Well, seven or eight of us went over there. And he took off his helmet, threw it on the ground. He says, "Boys, I'm ready to go. I feel comfortable. I'm ready to meet my maker." Well, most of us weren't quite ready. So we kept our helmets on. But, and I don't remember what he said. But the fact that he didn't have to be there. He could have been in the valley. Mm-hmm. And he was too old to be walking around the mountains anyway. Mm-hmm. And I never saw him again. So I don't know what happened to him. One more story in the Casino front, and then I'll come back to Anzio again. But we were to do an attack on a German position. The attack was to begin at midnight. This is, of course, in Italy, and it was in late January. There was a man in the company who was in what we call the Pioneer Platoon, who were engineers, really. And he was from Chicago. His name was Joe Ecosiatic. very quiet man. If there was ever a man out of place in the Army, it was Joe. Never talked much, and some reason he took a liking to me. He'd come over and talk to me when we could. Well, our attack began at midnight, and we were along with the all the others. And we met machine gun fire all the way up the hill. Just terrific machine gun. Every time we'd move and we'd hit a rock and it'd roll down the mountain, although the Germans couldn't see any better than we could, they nevertheless fired in the direction of the noises. And then it got so intense that the German artillery fired right in on its own positions, mm-hmm. because we were intermingled with them. And their positions were so protected that they could withstand some of their own artillery, mm-hmm. where we were out in the flat open. We were flattened out on the ground there for a minute or two, undergoing a lot of machine gun fire. And suddenly, Joe was at my side. Now, he should have been with his platoon. I said, "Joe, you're in the wrong place. You need to be with your platoon." He didn't say anything. But then there was a rip of machine gun, and I could feel the impact of it hitting Joe. Mm. And then the sparks right in front of my nose. I was flat, and sparks off the bullets hitting the rock. I could see, and I heard Joe moan. He didn't talk, and we got the word to continue the attack. I sent word back by someone behind me, said, "Tell the medics that Joe's up here and he's wounded." Mm-hmm. And we continued the attack. I ran forward, found a little animal shed of some sort that I was trying to snuggle around, and found out I was nothing more than dried manure that I was in. And but then a word came to fall back. "It's useless. We're not going to get through. Go back to the base of the mountain from where we started." And down the hill we went. I got down to the hill and I said, "Did anybody see Joe? Or did they bring him down?" Nobody seemed to know anything about him. So First Sergeant said, "Ralph, you know where he is. You and take a couple other guys, see if you can go get him. You try not to leave your wounded." So we started back up the hill again, machine gun fire. And we got to Joe. He was still alive. Put him on a stretcher and went down to the base of the hill looking for a first aid station. And we were carrying him, so that the four of us by that time carrying him. And we got machine pistol fire. The Germans mm-hmm. had infiltrated our line and were firing. And they hit one of the stretcher carriers through the shoulder. But we weren't too far from an aid station. We got there. Joe died in a couple of hours. Mm. But again, he was one of those people who just a total misfit in the Army. This was so alien to him, things like this. Mm-hmm. But that was things that happened on the casino front. Well, at Anzio, the breakthrough came. Our division broke out of that ring of steel. But General Mark Clark, who was a general of the Fifth Army, American Army in Italy, decided that a little piece of glory should come his way. And instead of cutting across from east or from west to east and trapping the Germans who were in Cassino, Mark Clark said, "We're going to Rome." Mm. He turned and up the coastal highways to Rome. And about 70 to 80,000 German soldiers were able to escape back up the peninsula to fight again.
Mm.
It was a bad mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And General Clark got great pictures of himself walking into Rome with a pistol on his hip. And it was...
Was that realized at the time?
Beg your pardon?
Was that realized at the time that that was a mistake and that so many Germans escaped?
It was. It was by most people, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it was. He should have been demoted. I think he got a real tongue-lashing from Eisenhower, from what I've heard, but, what I've read. And he came back to the, after the war was over, and he became a commandant for a boys' military school on the East Coast.
Now, when you were engaged in these battles, did you understand what the overall strategy was?
A lot of times we did. Mm-hmm. Yeah. A lot of times we did. There were other times when we were absolutely in the dark,
mm-hmm.
and wondering what in the world are we doing, and it just depended on the situation and how able some of our regimental commanders were and gleaning some information
mm-hmm.
from or other sources. But we got up toward Rome, and here again we had a most unusual circumstance. We had been fighting south of Rome another division called the Bicycle Division. It was a German division that traveled on bicycles.
Hmm.
Unusual. And we had pretty well routed them, and they'd retreated to a point north. They left a lot of equipment around, including a lot of bicycles. We were at a rest for a day or two, gather our forces and then go on toward Rome. So our fellows had gotten some of these bicycles, and they were having fun riding around on the bicycles. They were also using some of the German tents and other kinds of German equipment. And all of a sudden, down comes a squadron of fighter planes. And they looked down and they saw some troops on the bicycle.
Oh.
And now this was a squadron of called the Tuskegee Airmen. They were black airmen. They were probably the best fighting fighter plane units in the army. They never lost a plane, a bomber. They escorted bombers. But they could only go so far with bombers because they didn't have the fuel tanks. So they'd escort them a certain distance, and then they'd fly back and land and wait mm-hmm. for the bombers to come back partway, and then they'd meet them again and escort them on home. But they looked down, and saw these guys on bicycles, and they knew that they had the the bicycle division. It had to be them. Mm-hmm. So they came down and strafed us.
Oh, wow.
50 caliber machine guns. Two of the planes. The third plane recognized what was going on. He radioed the others. We only lost one man, thank goodness. But the next day, up came these flyers, the Tuskegee Airmen. And they came up and wanted to apologize for the mistake they'd made. Now, we'd been strafed by airplanes before our own. Mm-hmm. With my first day in the unit with the 25th of December, we'd been strafed by American planes. First time I'd been shot at. And in this instance, we only lost the one man. But never did anybody come up and apologize for the mistake, but these guys did. Mm-hmm. Last year, here at the University of Illinois, the Tuskegee Airmen, what's left of them, came here for a meeting, and I got to tell them about the strafing incident. So it was kind of a nice meeting. There are five or six of them left. They had to be college graduates. That was a distinction they made for the black pilots. The other pilots didn't have to be college trained, but they put this kind of a barrier up there. Well, these guys were great airmen. They never lost a bomber. So it's kind of a side issue. Just south of Rome. Rome, we were on the edge of Rome the night of the June 4th. My division was right on the outskirts. We were to go in either on the 5th or the 6th. And there had been an agreement that Rome would not be fought over. Somehow, through the Vatican, perhaps, through scholars who said, "Save this." It wasn't fought over. And I don't know whether I should tell this or not. But again, I was with the Texas Division, and they were having quite a party south of Rome. They'd gotten some wine from someplace. Well. A couple of other fellows, and we decided that we'd like to see a little bit of Rome. And there wasn't anyone, no one was watching the chicken coop. So we got into a jeep, and we went up to the edge of Rome, the outskirts, to some streets, drove around a little bit, didn't see a soul. Street, the buildings were shuttered tight, and we thought about that for a little while and said, you know, this might not be the best place for us. So we left and went back to our unit, and we made an unauthorized visit to Rome. But the next, we really occupied Rome on June 6th, which was my birthday on 1944.
Then Rome, you were
Rome
20 years old?
I was 20.
Yes.
The Roman citizens had their shutters open. There were thousands of them on the street, just cheering and clapping. And at 5:30 in the morning or 6 o'clock, I was walking right by the Roman Colosseum, something I'd read about all my life. There it was. And I'll never forget one Italian gentleman yelling at us from the curb. He says, "It is good that you are looking." And we didn't stop in Rome. We went right through. Mm. We met resistance a few miles north, some initial resistance, and then on to Magliano, Italy, a town of about 30 or 40,000 people, and we were going to attack that town. This would have been about the 12th, 13th of June. Mm-hmm. And we were waiting for the tanks to catch up with us. And the tanks were going to help us as we attacked this town. Our first sergeant asked me and another member of the of our squad, a fellow by the name of Waylon Dawes, to go out to the road that the tanks would be coming up and direct the tanks into the olive grove that we were mm-hmm. trying to hide in. You know, although the Germans pretty well knew we were there. So he said, first sergeant says, go out to this gate, wait there. We got out there, and we were met by machine gun fire. We knew that it was some distance away and wasn't too worried about it because there was a big stone fence that we could get behind. And we knew that those bullets were pretty well spent by the time they got to this stone fence. So we just plopped ourselves down on the ground, waited for the tanks. And tanks didn't come, and they didn't come. And finally, I guess that the Germans finally figured out that I and Waylon Dawes were at this point, and they threw in two rounds, two mortar rounds. Mm. And we were both wounded. Dawes was hit in the knee pretty bad. Eventually, he got to go home. I was hit just generally all over. From the head, I had a piece go through my helmet, mm. lodged there, about here, but fortunately not through the skull. And I hit in the armpit, buttocks, legs, ankles, soles of my feet.
Mm.
The worst wound was in his left leg. I lost a lot of muscle from it, and it's still a problem area. But first aid came quickly. The Germans decided not to throw any more mortars, and we were put into a ambulance at some point. We were taken to a field hospital and then on down to Anzio, to another hospital. And from Anzio, we flew out to Naples to another field hospital in a tent. And there we had major surgery done to remove pieces. And I was in that hospital for about 3.5 weeks, 4 weeks, and then got out and was sent to a reconditioning camp. And that was on my way back to my own unit.